Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Students around the world are asking questions about God, the truth, and the meaning of their lives. Your gift will put top-notch Catholic intellectuals in front of students who are seeking. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students to transform a student's life today. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students.
But this evening we're going to start by just zooming right in on one area of his teaching, a teaching which contains truths of which our generation, I think, desperately needs to be reminded. We're zooming in on his teaching on the human person, what some might call his anthropology, although that's not a term he uses. And just to point you at the start to the relevant sections of St. Thomas's work, where you can go and study this for yourself. The key passages are chapters 56 to 90, of book 2 of the Summa Quadra Gentiles. I should have put this in the handout, but I can give them to you later. So 56 to 90 of book 2 of the Summa Quadra Gentiles. Also Thomas's commentary on Aristotle's De Anima, if you're really geeking out. And then the mainstay of it all, questions 75 to 93 of the Prima Pars, the first part of the Summa Theologiae. That's where you'll find Thomas's treatment of the human person. So that first part of the Summa Theologiae we'll see tomorrow is about God and creation. And in his account of creation, Thomas first discusses spiritual creatures, the angels, and then the creation of corporeal creatures, the earth, water, plants, animals. And then he turns, as you can see in text 1 on your handout, to man as the bridge between these two realms. We now proceed to treat of man, who is composed of a spiritual and corporeal substance. And note the singular there. Not composed of a spiritual substance and a corporeal substance, but composed of a spiritual and corporeal substance, ex spirituali et corporali substantia. We'll be focusing this evening on exactly that aspect of Thomas's teaching on the human person. That is the claim that the human person is a composite unity of body and soul, with the soul united to the body as its form. So I'll explain shortly what Aquinas means by that, but it's worth pointing out that there were philosophical alternatives at the time that Thomas was writing, strong alternatives. So whenever Aquinas treats of the human soul, he'll always refer to the position of Plato, for example. He doesn't agree with it, but he can't avoid it. For Plato, what a man is his soul. And the relationship between soul and body is that between mover and moved, like a sailor in his ship. Or for the fans of the Turtles here, like Krang. Oh, this dramatic pause. There you go. Krang, very, very briefly, in his exosuit. This idea of the soul as like the sailor in the ship of the body is very much not Aquinas' understanding of human being. In his treatment of the body-soul relationship, Aquinas is incredibly careful to defend the real animality and the real spirituality of men and women, as we'll see. The human person is not, for him, a soul which happens to have a body, but is a spiritual and physical unity. So when I first studied all of this, As an undergrad, I found it challenging because I was basically a bit of a Platonist, as many, many of us are. But more and more, it strikes me as deeply wise and beautifully congruent with the Christian faith and increasingly important in our time. Why important in our time? Because the human person is something we are deeply confused about. Throughout history, there have always been people who denied the existence of a spiritual soul, who thought that humans are merely bodies, fancy biological machines. And on the other extreme, there have always been people who thought, like Plato, that the human being is to be identified with the spiritual soul and that the body is a mere appendage to the soul or even a prison for the soul. But in our time, the really strange thing in our time is that many people seem to want to affirm both of these contradictory positions at once. What do I mean? Without going into the whole transgender question, it's really striking, I think, how people talk about this topic. My body is one thing, but my true self, who I really am, the inner me, is another thing entirely. And this invisible self is held to be sovereign in an important sense. The body might need to be drastically altered in order to give visible expression to this spiritual self. That's a fairly widespread way of understanding the human person today, I think it's fair to say. But at the same time, many people, when they're asked the question, will deny that they believe in a spiritual soul. Humans are mere bodies for them. So in a major survey recently, fewer than 50% of Britons said they thought humans had a soul as well as a body. In other words, if they're consistent, they believe that we are objects in the world, merely physical objects, who, like sticks and stones, obey physical laws. We may be very fancy and complicated, but that's essentially what we are. And our apparent freedom is, in fact, illusory. It must be. People don't like to think too much about this deterministic worldview too often, but we can see it winking at us in our culture, I think, in the popularity of phrases like, it is what it is. I just killed your entire family. It is what it is. And if we're proper materialists, that's all we really can say. Things are what they are and could never have been otherwise. So with respect to beliefs about body and soul in our time, we have widespread Platonism, let's call it, and widespread materialism. And it seems to me that there is, in fact, a very large overlap between these two contradictory positions. The same people, and I found this again and again empirically, that will hold that human beings are to be identified with their bodies. There's no such thing as a soul, and that human beings are not to be identified with their bodies. I am a woman, and I want to alter my male body to reflect this spiritual reality. Thomas's anthropology in this context is particularly valuable because it recalls us to a common sense and well-balanced perspective on the real materiality and real spirituality of the human condition. So that's enough justification of the topic. Let's actually get into it. But the first thing to make clear is that when we speak of soul in St. Thomas, we are not speaking only about the religious dimension of the human person, or the part of me that prays, or the part of me that has privileged contact with God. His general account of the soul is far more basic than that. And you can see this general definition in text 2 on your handout. Soul designates the difference between living things and non-living things. He says it is the first principle of life of those things which are alive. The first principle of life in those things which are alive. Now, living things do lots of varied activities, which each have their own principles or starting points. So when a fish is looking at you from its fishbowl, we can say that one of its organs, its eye, is the principle of this activity, sight. And there are many other activities going on in the fish at the same time, digestion, movement, and so on. But there is a unity in the fish. It is not just a jumbled gathering of physical activity. It is one living thing. You could tell a story about this fish. So there must be some one principle which accounts for all this activity. It can't just be the fact that these physical parts are together, since a corpse immediately after death has the same parts. So there is some distinct principle of life in this living thing, and we call this principle soul. We see some living things which have a very limited range of activities, plants. They grow, they nourish themselves, and so on. And we designate their souls vegetative souls or nutritive souls. Other living things can do a bit more. They move around, for example. They have senses like sight and hearing, and we can say they have sensitive souls. But then there are other living things which don't just sense the things around them, but abstract from these particular things and gain knowledge, not just sense knowledge of this particular thing, which happens to be an oak tree or a rose bush, say, but knowledge of oak trees and rose bushes, which transcends my immediate sense experience of this or that particular thing. So the kind of knowledge we could call intellectual knowledge, or we could call it understanding. It's this knowledge that makes language possible, for example. Not just this, this, and this, but table, lectern, and picture. And with this knowledge, these living things are obviously human beings, you've guessed it by now, can reason and can act freely. We can make judgments about how to act based on our intellectual knowledge, judgments which are simply impossible to animals which only have sense knowledge. So I can come to know, for example, that this disgusting medicine is good for me, and I can freely choose to take it. I can see a deep-fried Mars bar, and although it looks repulsive, you tell me, using language and referring therefore to universals, you tell me that it's delicious, and so I eat. So to sum up, by simply observing the life of human beings without any reference to divine revelation, we can say that human beings have a distinct kind of soul, and we call it a rational soul, or an intellectual soul, or a spiritual soul. Now, there's an important difference, Aquinas will say, between the souls of animals and the intellectual soul of a human being. The souls of animals, he says, don't have any operation of their own apart from the body. This is an important point. A dog is gaining sense knowledge through his eyes and ears and nose about this bush, this tree, this cat. It's all at the level of bodies that this is happening. But a human does something more. The human intellect gives access to universals, including abstractions like justice and truth and love. And in this sense, is operating on a different plane, an incorporeal, immaterial plane. Elsewhere in his treatment of God's knowledge, there's a really beautiful phrase. Thomas says, the nature of a non-intelligent being is more contracted and more limited. So think of a tree there or a dog and so on. Whereas the nature of intelligent beings has a greater amplitude and extension. We reach out into the world. And he quotes a fascinating phrase then in Aristotle, the soul, that is the human soul, is in a sense all things. We can somehow have access to anything in the world through our senses and through our ability to abstract from our senses. And it's this ability of the mind to wander in the immaterial realm of ideas that enables Thomas to insist that the human soul has its own proper operation distinct from the body's operation, and that therefore it is a subsisting thing which is incorruptible and can, in the case of death, exist independently of the body. And so we're just pondering this with an example. So you'll have to use your imaginations here. Imagine a woman walking with her dog in a forest. How do each of the beings there relate to the world around them, according to this picture of Thomas? The trees are all alive, but they are in no way gaining knowledge of the world around them. They're just doing their own thing. They stay within themselves, if you like. The dog has highly developed senses, and through its senses is connecting with all kinds of beings. This bush, that mouse, the birds overhead. But the dog, there's Krang back again. The dog, we'll see if the connection's working actually. There you go, there's the dog. Briefly making an appearance. So the dog lacks an intellectual soul, and so is limited to sense knowledge of these individual things it experiences. But the woman is quite an extraordinary being. She is existing. She is growing. She is perhaps digesting a pack of Doritos. And so she shares a certain dimension of life with the trees around her. She's also smelling the wild garlic, and she's hearing the bird song. And so she shares another dimension of life with her dog. But at the very same time, she could be thinking about trees, not just this tree, this tree, this tree, but thinking about trees as such. She might be thinking about forestry practices. She might be thinking about the forestry policy of the current government and forestry policy in the EU. She might then be thinking about Brexit or Scottish independence or a return to the Pan-Gaelic kingdom of Dalriada. She might even be thinking about the very fact of creation itself, the existence of this world we live in, and the grandeur of her own being within it. Or she might just be thinking about that pack of Doritos. All these intellectual paths are open to her as she walks through this way in the forest. She is, to quote the poet Patrick Kavanagh, she is free in the oriental streets of thought. So Aquinas' account of the soul makes very clear the difference between human beings and irrational animals. It's worth noting here, by the way, that some scholars at the time Aquinas was writing described this complexity of human ensoulment in terms of three distinct souls. This woman has a vegetative soul doing vegetative things, a sensitive soul doing sensitive things, and a rational soul doing rational things. But Thomas insisted that humans have one soul, one rational soul, which assumes all the operations proper to sensitive souls and vegetative souls in other living things. One argument he gives for this is that the fact that our sensitive appetites, like our hunger or our anger, can interfere with higher processes. You all know how hard it is to think straight when you're hangry. Now, this affirmation of one soul versus three souls, it might sound like splitting hairs, but it's hugely important, and we'll come back to it. But I'll just add here that Thomas's teacher, Albert, who's the patron saint of the chaplaincy for those of you in Edinburgh, as far as I know, when he wrote his big book on animals, which is really a wonderful read, and all of the various features of animals, he had a section there discussing the perfection of animals, which is the most perfect animal. And he answers that it's humans who are the most perfect animals. But humans aren't the strongest animals. And there are other animals who have a better sense of smell, keener eyesight, and so on. So Albert gives the example of the lynx. A lynx has famously sharp eyesight. That's the wrong lynx. There's the lynx. There's the lynx, exactly. So a lynx has famously sharp eyesight. So how can we defend the superiority then of man? Albert says that even though the lynx sees more keenly, that sight remains at the level of sense. Whereas in us, it's taken into, it's assumed into a higher activity. So our eyesight in that sense is superior to that of a lynx. A lynx might be able to see a mouse 250 foot away, but it's never going to lead him to reflect on Brexit or Scottish independence and so on, to be a lynx. Now, I thought of this point that Albert makes when I read Pope Francis' letter on Blaise Pascal, which was just released yesterday, I think, or the day before. It's a fascinating document. And he quotes Pascal there saying, "Man is but a reed, the most feeble thing in nature, but he is a thinking reed." That's that point that Albert is making. That makes all the difference for him. So now we've covered the idea that humans have an intellectual soul which is distinct from the body and can exist independently of the body after death. But what about the question of how the soul is united to the body? So we know what option Thomas will want to rule out, the Krang option, the Plato option, where the soul is simply inhabiting the body, moving it, using it, but not really belonging to it. Aquinas describes the union in much more intimate terms. The soul is the form of the body, he says. So what do we mean by form? Very briefly, this is a really scratch on the surface. In Aristotle's Metaphysics, every substance is understood to be composed of form and matter. Form being the metaphysical principle that makes a thing to be the kind of thing it is, and matter being the metaphysical principle that makes this particular thing distinct from every other thing of that kind. So matter used in this sense is potentially any kind of thing, and it is form that actualizes it, and makes it this particular kind of thing. So this flashing orange is a substance composed of the form of orangeness, which makes it like every other orange, and the individual matter, which makes it distinct from every other orange. You can't separate the form from the matter in the orange. You can't point to one part of it and say, here's the form, or here's the matter. You can't separate them like that. In the same way, according to Thomas, the rational soul is the form of the human body. The soul makes this lump of matter to be a human body. And when the soul and body separate at death, the remains are no longer a human body. If the soul is the form of the body, then they belong together, they work together, and they are inseparable in this life. You can't point to any part of yourself and say, here is my body separate from my soul. Or here is my soul separate from my body. Everywhere you point, you will be indicating ensouled flesh, or if you like, enfleshed soul. Your whole soul, your rational soul, is present in every part of your body. Thomas affirms this explicitly. If the soul was like Krang in his exosuit, then maybe you could associate it with one part of your body. This is what Descartes does, for example. He associates it with the pineal gland. But if it's the form of the body, then it informs the whole and every part. And if someone asks you where your soul is, you could point just as well to your big toe as to your head or your heart or wherever else. Now, if the soul is the form of the body, then we must clearly identify the person in this life, not with the soul alone, but with the composite whole, body and soul, physical and spiritual. And it's not the case, on Thomas's account, that the spiritual dimension is just plonked on top of or next to the physical. There's a kind of knitting at work in Thomas's account. Two threads being knitted into the same scarf, if you like. I didn't know if it was possible to knit with two threads. Google Images tells me it sure is. So two threads being knitted into the same scarf. There is one soul, one rational soul operating to greater or lesser effect at every level of the human being, down to the lowest bodily function. A man is, you could say, spiritual all the way down and physical all the way up. Whether he's playing Beethoven on the piano or snoring in bed, whether he's dancing a polka or saying a wee prayer, he is operating as the physical spiritual composite God made him to be. And as physical spiritual composites, we humans find ourselves at a vital junction in the great chain of being from God to quarks and leptons. We're at the meeting point of the corporeal and the intellectual. We're the connecting point, the bridge between these two realms, the horizon, as Thomas says, of things corporeal and things incorporeal. I think I've given you the text in your handout. It might be number 3, but I've given it to you there, I think. So we're the horizon point, we're the connecting point, we're the junction, and so on. And everything he's saying here so far is properly philosophical, just to make that clear. But you can see here how the ground is being prepared for a fuller, richer theological understanding of the priestly vocation of humanity, speaking towards heaven, praise and thanksgiving on behalf of all material creation. Now, I remember reading these texts in St. Thomas as an undergraduate and being blown away. It led me to question a good chunk of my self-understanding and led me to reread my own self, if you like. It was really mind-blowing to become more profoundly aware of the wonder of my being at that stage in my life when self-reflection is so important. I'd find myself after a few pints of Grolsch getting out my big toe to show everyone where my soul was. We're rational animals, man. Think about it, rational animals. I am the horizon of things corporeal and things incorporeal. If tattoos were more popular at the time, I'd probably have that tattooed on my hand. But it was only over the intervening years that I came to appreciate how this Thomistic anthropology, let's call it, pays out in so many areas of theology and the Christian life. In understanding the sacraments and our liturgical practices generally, in appreciating our faith in the resurrection of the dead, that dogma makes very little sense if we are really to be identified with our souls and not our bodies also. And above all, it pays out in our understanding of the moral life. In the Summa Theologiae, it's the second part, as some of you will know, that contains Thomas's moral teaching, divided into two smaller sections. And it's so unlike, when you read St. Thomas, it's so unlike the moral philosophy of people like Kant and the utilitarians. They're seeking abstract principles that you can then apply in all kinds of different situations. The greatest good for the greatest number, or whatever you like to say. But Thomas just pays attention to the human being in all its richness. That's all he's doing in his moral philosophy and theology. He's paying attention to the human being at all of its various levels. In his discussion of morality, he's just working his way through all the powers of the human soul and body and investigating how they can be perfected so as to work in harmony with the guiding light of reason. Now, theologically, he's interested also in how grace perfects us, how we can come to share in God's life and so on. But his first concern is simply to show how our own beings find coherence so that our rationality guides and governs this complex network of our being. This vision of the human being as a complex unity which straddles two realms of existence, it's a really magnificent one, I think. And it really helps us guard against ancient and contemporary errors. Now, it's not without its problems, and I'm not saying it's the last word in Christian anthropology, but it seems to me to sum up and safeguard so much of what is true about the human being, human life, human experience, and it is wonderfully congruent with what is revealed to us by God as true, the resurrection of the dead, the new creation, and so on. It's not an easy vision to maintain, though, especially as the culture around us does so much to disconnect us from the broader chain of being, material and spiritual, or rather to render us unaware of our connections with the chain of being and our distinct place within the chain of being. Urbanization causes us to forget our fellowship with the beasts, and secularization causes us to forget our fellowship with the angels. I'm going to finish by suggesting two ways for us to hold on to the truth of our composite being in the midst of contemporary lies. The first involves ecology, and the second, fantasy. So first, ecology. Here we are. As Christians, we're sometimes nervous of talk which emphasizes the fact that we are animals among other animals, because it seems to elide the difference between us and other animals. But in this nervousness, we risk, I think, losing a properly Christian sense of our animality and a wise appreciation of what we share with eagles and hedgehogs. One of the most popular forms of theological writing in Christian theology for a millennium or so, from Basil the Great on, was the hexameron. Any of you familiar with that term? The hexameron comes from the Greek for 6 days. It was a commentary, often a preached commentary, on the 6 days of creation, often including highly detailed observations about the appearance and behavior of plants and animals. So David Attenborough has nothing on Basil the Great talking about the migration patterns of fish. I'm not even joking. I mean, have a look at Basil the Great's Hexameron. It's really, really fascinating. And even I love reading about the natural world. And eventually I'm just like, come on, Basil, you know, enough of this nonsense. But it's really, really they're fascinating texts. In these texts, you have these detailed observations about the natural world before coming to the human and then setting him in his place in this beautifully described kingdom. So St. Ambrose, in his Hexameron at one point, he imagines an interlocutor asking why on earth he is chatting about fish tails and beaver paws and so on. And Ambrose says, I think it's text 5 on your handout, the order which Scripture laid down must be retained. Isn't that fascinating? The order which Scripture laid down must be retained. We cannot fully know ourselves, he says, without first knowing the nature of all living creatures. Whoa. We cannot know ourselves without first knowing the world of plants and animals and so on. And you could contrast this hexameral anthropology, if you like to call it, with St. Augustine's approach to the human person, which starts more or less with introspection. Just look within, just enter into the cave of my own being. And I actually find that Augustinian approach, which is really influential in modern times in Christian context as well, I think I find that a little bit less helpful than this more kind of this extrospective approach to the human person. So I must say I really like this sort of ecological way of approaching the human person, and I find it immensely helpful to deliberately and consciously spend time outside of the anthroposphere, by the sea, in the woods, on a farm. You gain a sense of yourself there as an animal. You gain a sense of your own community with these beasts. I think the lives of the saints, it's no accident that the lives of the saints, especially the early saints from these islands, they're full of stories about this or that saint finding a kind of friendship with lower animals, whether it's Brigid and the fox, Cuthbert and the otters who used to dry his feet when he came out of praying in the sea, Benedict and the raven, or St. Gall and his bear. Now, I'd be interested to hear from you what kind of ecological experiences you have had along these lines, or that you would recommend as aids in appreciating our own animality. Of course, for us Christians, this is an ecology that includes the angels too. We experience fellowship with birds in the forest and fellowship with the angels in the Eucharist. And in both of these ways, we become more aware of our place in the cosmos and of the marvelous connection of creatures. I went to visit a Cistercian monastery in Freiburg a few years ago, and there you had the monks coming in from the farm, stinking of manure, and coming into this church which was soon smelling beautifully of incense. And I think it's that, you know, straddling these two worlds is really, really significant. So that's the ecological approach, if you like. The second way I'm proposing to help us gain or regain a sense of the wonder of our human being is fantasy literature. And I'm thinking especially here of the works of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Both of these authors view fantasy not as providing an irresponsible escape from reality, but as providing a brief sojourn in another world, a secondary world, in order precisely to enable the reader to return to the primary world with a new zest for life and a renewed appreciation of the strange wonder of real life and of our being. And one of the most important aspects of the secondary worlds that these authors created, I think, is the fact that they contain other rational animals. It's not just human beings in those other worlds. Think of the elves, dwarves, hobbits, ents, and so on in Tolkien's Legendarium. Think of the unfallen rational animals. Have any of you read C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy? Anybody or some of you? Yeah, wonderful stuff. Think of the hnau, isn't that the term that's used? The hnau, the rational animals who are unfallen in that trilogy. The Hrossa, the Fifiltrigi, the Ceroni. You're looking at all of them here. I can tell you what, look these characters up on Google Images and you will not sleep for a week. There are some terrifying illustrations of them. And then think also of the talking beasts of Narnia. These are all rational animals. They're sufficiently unlike us that we find them fascinating and novel and we pay attention to them. And they're sufficiently like us that the attention we pay to them is ultimately attention paid to our own condition. I remember reading The Magician's Nephew when I was about 8 years old and coming to the passage that I've given on your handout where Aslan wakes the irrational creatures of Narnia. Be walking trees, be talking beasts. Aslan calls them into this condition that we share, the condition of rational animals, and he does it as a gift, but with a warning. Their freedom carries responsibility for others, a kind of stewardship of the dumb beasts. Out of them, and it includes also the possibility of returning to irrationality. There's a warning here. Out of them you were taken, and into them you can return. Do not so. Even as an eight-year-old, I remember realizing in that moment the majesty of my own making, the dignity and the burden of being a free and intelligent animal. That's heavy stuff for an eight-year-old. And the more I read and reread, the more I read now and reread the works of Lewis and Tolkien and others like them, the more deeply I receive the truth of our human condition articulated in different terms by St. Thomas Aquinas. So this talk has been about the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, but it has also been about you, about your life and your being, and I'm interested now to hear whether you find his treatment to be true.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.